The Mask of the Red Death. The Red Death had long been destroying the country. No disease had ever been so deadly or so terrible. Blood was the form it chose. Its mark was the redness and the horror of blood. Its victims suffered sharp pains and sudden dizziness. There was heavy bleeding at the pores and then death. This resulted in bright red stains upon the body, and especially on the face. It caused the victim to be shut away from the help and sympathy of others. The disease took only about a half hour to strike and kill. But Prince Prospero was happy, daring, and wise. When half of his people had died, he sent for 1,000 healthy and light-hearted friends. He chose these people from among the knights and ladies of his court. Then he and his friends retired behind the walls of one of his castles. The building was large and magnificent. A strong, high wall surrounded it. This wall had gates of iron. The servants brought furnaces and hammers and welded shut the bolts of the gate. There was to be no entrance or exit from the castle for whatever reason. The outside world could take care of itself. In the meantime, it was foolish to grieve or to think. The prince had provided all the means of pleasure. There were clowns, ballet dancers, and musicians. There was plenty of food, and there was wine. All this and security remained inside. Outside was the Red Death. The prince and 1,000 friends stayed in seclusion for the next 6 months. All the while, the disease spread throughout the land. Then, the prince decided to hold a masked ball of the most unusual kind. It was a great and wonderful affair. But first, let me tell of the rooms in which it was held. There were 7, a royal suite. In many palaces, such suites form a long and straight line. The folding doors slide back nearly to the walls on either side. This way, the view of the whole suite is hardly blocked. Here, the case was very different, as might have been expected from the prince's love of the bizarre. The suite was set up so oddly that one could barely see more than one room at a time. There was a sharp turn at every 20 or 30 yards, and at each turn there was a different effect. To the right and left, in the middle of each wall, was a tall and narrow window. This window looked out upon a closed hallway that followed the turns of the suite. These windows were made of stained glass. The color of the glass matched the decorations of the room into which the window opened. For example, the room at the eastern end had blue decorations, and its windows were a deep blue. The second room had purple ornaments and tapestries, and here the panes were purple. The third room was green throughout, and so were the windows. The fourth room was furnished and lighted with orange, the fifth with white, the sixth with violet. The seventh room was closely covered in black velvet tapestries. They hung all over the ceiling and down the walls. They fell in heavy folds upon a carpet of the same material and color. But in this room only, the color of the windows failed to match the decorations. The panes here were scarlet, a deep blood-red color. In not one of the 7 rooms was there any lamp or candelabrum. In fact, there was no light of any kind coming from within the suite. But in the hallways, opposite each window, stood a table. On this table was a metal container with a flame that reflected off the tinted glass and lit up the room. This light produced many fantastic sights. But the effect in the black room was different. The firelight that streamed in upon the dark curtains and the blood-tinted panes was horrible. It produced a wild look on the faces of all those who entered, and there were few in the company bold enough to set foot inside the room at all. In this room, there was also a huge ebony clock. Its pendulum swung back and forth with a dull, heavy clang. And each hour there came from the clock a clear, loud, deep sound. The sound was so unusual that each hour the orchestra was forced to pause to listen to it. The waltzers, too, stopped their dancing, and the entire happy crowd was upset for a moment. However, when the sound stopped, a light laughter once again filled the room. The musicians looked at each other and smiled, as if at their own foolishness. And they made whispering vows to each other that the next time the clock chimed, they would not stop playing. Yet, when another hour had passed and the clock chimed, the same uneasiness was felt by all. In spite of these things, it was a merry and magnificent affair. The tastes of the prince were strange. He had a fine eye for color and effect. He ignored the normal rules of fashion. His plans were bold and fiery. There were some who would have thought him mad, yet his followers felt he was not. He had chosen, in large part, the colors and decorations of the 7 rooms for this great party, and it was his own taste that had set the tone for the masqueraders. To be sure, the costumes were strange or ugly. There was much glare and glitter, and much that was unreal. There were strange figures with unusual legs and arms. There were wild designs. There was much of the beautiful and much of the bizarre. There was something of the terrible and something of that which might cause disgust. Back and forth in the 7 rooms stalked the many masqueraders, appearing as if they were dreams. These dreams twisted in and about, taking color from the rooms. And they caused the wild music of the orchestra to seem like the echo of their steps. Then, the ebony clock struck. For a moment, all was still and silent except the voice of the clock. The dreams seemed frozen as they stood, but the echoes of the sound died away. They had lasted only for an instant, and a light, quiet laughter floated after them. Then the music swelled, and the dreams came to life again, twisting and turning more merrily than ever. But to the most westward room, the black room, none of the maskers had gone. For there, through the blood-colored panes, flowed a deep, mysterious light, and the blackness of the drapes added to the terrifying effect. The other rooms were very crowded, and in them beat the heart of life. The party went gaily on until finally the clock struck midnight. Then the music stopped, as I have told. The dancing of the waltzers was halted, and there was an uneasy quietness as before. Now there were 12 strokes of the clock to be sounded. Perhaps with more time, more thought crept into the minds of the crowd. And perhaps, too, before the final chime had sounded, many in the crowd had become aware of a certain masked figure. This figure had not drawn the attention of anyone before. Now, the rumor of his presence was spreading, and there arose a murmur of disapproval and surprise. These feelings turned finally to ones of terror and disgust. It may be thought that among this strange crowd, no such costume could have caused such a feeling. In truth, the nature of the costumes that night knew no limits. But the figure in question had gone even beyond the prince's tastes. The whole company seemed to feel that the costume and manner of the stranger was neither amusing nor proper. The figure was tall and thin, and it was covered from head to foot in the clothing of the grave. The mask that covered the face was made to resemble the face of a stiffened corpse. And all of this might still have been accepted by the masqueraders. But this figure had gone so far as to assume the look of the Red Death. His clothing was dabbed in blood, and his entire face was sprinkled with the red horror. When Prince Prospero first set eyes upon this image, he began to shake violently. Then, in the next moment, his brow reddened with rage. "Who dares," he demanded of the servants who stood near him, "who dares insult us this way? Seize him and unmask him. That way we may know whom we have to hang at sunrise. Prince Prospero was in the eastern or blue room when he spoke these words, but they rang throughout the seven rooms loudly and clearly, for the prince was a bold and healthy man, and the music had become hushed at the waving of his hand. At first, the prince's servants made a slight rushing movement toward the figure, who was coming closer to the speaker. But the figure had inspired great fear among the crowd, so no one put out a hand to stop him. Without trouble, he passed within a yard of the prince. Then the huge crowd shrank back from the centers of the rooms toward the walls, and the figure made his way without interruption through the rooms. He walked with steady steps from the blue room to the purple. Then he moved from the purple to the green, through the green to the orange. He made his way through the orange to the white, and from there to the violet. It was then, however, that Prince Prospero rushed through the six rooms. He was mad with rage and filled with shame at his own lack of courage. But no one followed him, because a deadly terror had seized all. The prince held above him a drawn dagger. He approached to within 3 or 4 feet of the figure. Then the figure, having reached the entrance of the black room, turned suddenly to face him. There was a sharp cry, and the dagger dropped shining upon the sable carpet. An instant later, Prince Prospero fell face downward in death. Then, gathering a wild courage, a group of masqueraders ran into the black room. There they seized the figure, who stood tall and straight within the shadow of the clock. There was a gasp of horror, for the clothing and corpse-like mask, which they had so violently grabbed, was empty of any physical form. Now, the presence of the Red Death was recognized. He had come like a thief in the night. One by one, the partygoers dropped in the blood-stained halls of their party. The life of the ebony clock went out with the last of the masqueraders, and the flames outside the colored windows went out as well. Darkness and decay and the Red Death ruled over all. The Telltale Heart. Nervous, very, very nervous I had been and am. But why do you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed or dulled them. Especially sharp was the sense of hearing. I heard all things in heaven and on earth. I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Listen, and see how clearly and calmly I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how the idea first entered my brain, but once it was born, it haunted me day and night. There was no reason for it. There was no passion to it. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never insulted me. I had no desire for his gold. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. He had the eye of a vulture. It was a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it looked at me, my blood ran cold. And so, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man. This way, I would be rid of the eye forever. Now, this is the point. You think I am mad. Madmen know nothing. But you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely, how carefully I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him. Every night, about midnight, I turned the latch of his door, and I opened it, oh, so gently. gently. The opening I made was large enough for my head. I put in a dark lantern, all closed, so that no light shone out. Then I thrust in my head. You would have laughed to see how smartly I thrust it in. I moved it very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. Huh. Would a madman have been so wise as this? Then, when I was in the room, I undid the lantern carefully. Oh, so carefully. I undid it just enough so that a single thin ray fell upon the vulture eye. This I did for 7 long nights, every night, just at midnight. But I found the eye always closed, so it was impossible to do the work. For it was not the old man that annoyed me, but his evil eye. Every morning, when day broke, I went boldly into his room, and I spoke bravely to him. I called him by his first name in a friendly tone and asked how he had passed the night. So he would have been a very smart man indeed to suspect what I did every night at midnight. On the 8th night, I was more careful than ever in opening the door. Never before that night had I felt the strength of my powers, of my wisdom. I could hardly hold in my feelings of triumph. There I had been, opening the door little by little each night, and he did not even dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. I almost laughed at the idea, and perhaps he heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly, as if he were startled. Now, you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was pitch black, for the shutters were closed. So I knew he could not see the opening of the door. I kept pushing it open steadily, steadily. I had my head in. I was about to open the lantern when my thumb slipped on the tin fastening. The old man sprang up in the bed and cried out, "Who's there?" I kept quite still and said nothing. For a whole hour I did not move a muscle. And during that hour, I did not hear him lie down. He was sitting up in the bed, listening. Soon, I heard a slight groan. It was not a groan of pain or of grief. Oh, no. It was the low, muffled sound that comes up from the soul when it is filled with fear. I knew the sound well. Many a night, just at midnight, it had welled up from my own chest, and with its awful echo, it deepened the terrors that disturbed me. I knew what the old man felt, and I pitied him, although I chuckled at heart. I waited a long time without hearing him lie down. I decided to make a slight opening in the lantern. I did so quietly. You cannot imagine how quietly. Finally, a single dim ray shot out from the opening and fell upon the vulture eye. The eye was open, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it perfectly. It was a dull blue, with a disgusting veil over it that chilled my very bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's body. For I had directed the light right upon the spot. I have told you that what you mistake for madness is a sharpness of my senses. Now I say that what came to my ears was a low, dull, quick sound. It was a sound such as a watch makes when it is covered with cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury, as the beating of the drum stirs the soldier's courage. Yet I kept still. I hardly breathed. I did not move the lantern. I tried to hold the ray of light steadily upon the eye. Meantime, the horrible beating of the heart continued. It grew quicker and quicker and louder and louder. The old man's terror must have been rather intense. It grew louder, I say, louder every moment. Do you hear me? I told you that I am nervous. So I am. Now, at this dead hour of the night, in the awful silence of that old house, this strange noise excited me to great terror. The beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart would burst. Now, a new worry seized me. The sound would soon be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and jumped into the room. He cried out once, only once. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled happily to find the deed done. But for many minutes the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not bother me. It would not be heard through the wall. Finally, it stopped. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart and held it there for many minutes. There was no pulse. He was dead. His eye would trouble me no more. Do you still think me mad? You will think so no longer when I describe how I hid the body. I worked quickly, but in silence. I took up three planks from the floor. Then I placed the body under the boards and replaced them. I did this so cleverly that no human eye, not even his, could have found anything wrong. When I had finished, it was 4 o'clock, still dark as midnight. There came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart, for what had I now to fear? 3 men entered. They introduced themselves as officers of the police. A cry had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Someone suspected foul play. The police had been called, and these men were ordered to search the house. I smiled, for what had I to fear? The cry, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I said, was away in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I told them to search, search well. Finally, I led them to his room. I showed them his treasures, safe and secure. I brought chairs into the room and told them to rest here. And I placed myself in a chair above the very spot where the victim was buried. The officers were satisfied. I was at ease. They sat and talked of familiar things. But before long, I felt myself getting pale and wished them gone. My head ached, and I thought I heard a ringing in my ears. The ringing became clearer. I talked more freely to get rid of the sound. But it continued. Finally, I found that the noise was not within my ears. The sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much like a watch makes when it is covered with cotton. I gasped for breath. Yet the officers did not hear it. I talked more quickly, more forcefully, but the noise steadily increased. I paced the floor with heavy strides, but the noise steadily increased. Oh, God, what could I do? I swung the chair upon which I had been sitting and scraped it upon the boards, but the noise continued. It grew louder, 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 and still the men talked pleasantly. Was it possible they did not hear it? No. They heard. They suspected. They knew. They were making a fool of me. Anything was better than this agony. I could bear those awful smiles no longer. I felt I must scream or die. And now again, listen, louder, louder, louder. Villains, I cried, search no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here, here. It is the beating of his awful heart.